Hello there, and welcome to another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. First up, you'll meet a former All-American goalkeeper for the LSU women's soccer team who actually tried out for the Tigers football team. While she had success on the soccer field, her life was falling apart. But Mo Isom experienced God's faithfulness. You'll be hearing some of her story ahead. Then it's a report from the Olympic Games in Rio with Terry Beasy, doing ministry there with the organization International Sports Chaplains. Plus, Pastor Carl Gallups offers some insight into the transgender bathroom controversy and shares about a response he has developed for parents who wish for their students' modesty and privacy to be protected. And on this edition of The Intersection, more on that issue from Stuart Shepherd of Family Policy Alliance, which has developed a new initiative in which women relate their stories and concerns regarding members of the opposite sex invading their privacy. Then, conversation material from the recent International Christian Retail Show in Cincinnati, as Michelle Peremski of Team Lady 180 visited the Faith Radio Meeting House Broadcast Center to discuss a unique approach to grief recovery that she has developed. Finally, some comments from Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, representing Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore in the matter of a complaint against him involving an order he issued concerning the state's response to the U.S. Supreme Court decision on so-called same-sex marriage. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Mo Isom is a former star women's soccer player who attended LSU, and her on-the-field achievements were, well, off the charts. But her off-the-field and in-the-heart exploits were certainly destructive. She encountered adversity in her life, and God got her attention. She's written a book called Wreck My Life, Journeying from Broken to Bold. With some inspiration from a recent conversation, here now is Mo Isom.
After just struggling through so much adversity, just, you know, hammer swing after hammer swing after hammer swing, it felt like in life that the prayer initially really was kind of understanding why my dad had committed suicide and kind of desiring the same. It was a wreck my life of God, just end it. I understood that my dad did what he did, and I saw it as a viable option at one point. I was just in so much brokenness. It seemed like how easy it would be. And in the same sense, and this is twisted too, but it seemed like if my dad had the capacity to do this, am I not almost destined to do the same? Which is very sick and weird to think about, but when you're in so much pain, your brain just takes you to weird places. And so the prayer originally, wreck my life, was God, just end it, just wreck it. Just let's finish this off. But he responded by literally wrecking it on the interstate that night and literally wrecking my heart and revealing himself to me in the midst of that rubble and debris and that torn up Jeep. He interpreted wreck as very differently than I interpreted wreck. And I love his interpretation a lot more.
Yeah.
Because he did. He wrecked through all of the pain and all of the hardship and all of these lies and bondage that were holding me down. And he revealed himself and he began to write a new story. So that wreck my life kind of became a new empowering prayer, whereas it had begun as a very desperate prayer in a time that I was ready to give up.
Well, and there is a word that I know that you concentrate on in this book, and that word is control. And obviously things in your life at this time, at the time of the accident leading up to that, it sounds like to me things were spiraling out of control. And I assume that really you were, at least for a period of time, you were thinking you could fix things.
Oh, yes. I was... My own handyman, are we not all?
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Under the impression that if we can just do better and be better and do more and try harder, then certainly we can fix ourselves. That is a lie that I believed for a really long time. And I really think it's a lie that this generation is believing in a tremendous way that many generations have. It's this lie of our own personal strength. And I found in my own life, desperately trying to control my own circumstances, to write my own story. And then when things went south, to fix my own troubles, I mean, it just led me deeper and deeper and deeper into a downward spiral and a hole, because the truth of the matter is that we do not have the strength on our own. We really don't. And we live in this fake it till you make it culture of put your best foot forward, show your prettiest pieces, lead with your successes. And if there's hardship, keep that to yourself. Figure that out, you know, in the private, quiet places. And we become this world of people who are all equally struggling with tremendous hardship, whether it's crazy elements of the testimony or whether it's just the quiet hardship in our own soul. We're all struggling with these things, and we're all staying so quiet about it, thinking that we're the only people dealing with these broken things. And the fact of the matter is that Scripture actually calls us to boast in our weaknesses so that we can point to the cross and the glory of God. It calls us to share our hardships, to share our troubles, and it creates community, and it creates a group of people who can come together and actually be the living, breathing body of Christ. Because they're sharing in their hardship and they are finding their way back to the foot of the cross in that community. And so that was really a compelling reason to just write all of this out, to share all of this messiness and these broken pieces, and to write this book. Because I really believe that the more vulnerable we are, the more God is glorified. And if I can share my broken pieces and it can connect with any person, any degree of it can connect with something in their heart, then that's a battle won. And so that was really a great reason to write it, because of those control issues that seem to just be so prevalent and so human. And just writing a testimony that says, give up control. I did. And look what God's done. So yes, that is a strong theme through the book. And I happen to love the chapters the most where I surrendered that and he started to do a mighty work.
Mo Isom here on The Intersection. Learn more at moisom.com. Well, The Intersection continues now with evangelist Terry Veazey, who, while ministering at the Summer Olympics in Rio with international sports chaplains, took a few moments to report on his ministry activities as well as those of his team members. From that recent conversation, this is Terry Veazey.
Well, this is my third time now, Bob, to be with the International Sports Chaplains. We're a group that's headquartered out of Lynette, Alabama, close to West Point Lake. Our founder and director is a man named David Gwynn. David was an Olympic wrestler back in 1968 when he was 21 years old at the Mexico City Games. He was already a Christian at that time, and after those games, he ended up graduating from a Baptist school up in Tennessee, Hardin-Simmons, and then went to Southern Baptist Seminary in Fort Worth and became a college student pastor and had some very successful university student ministries around the country, his biggest probably being in Waco, Texas at First Baptist Church Waco, where Baylor University is. And he, I think at one time, had the largest university student ministry in America. And in 1988, David had the idea of putting together some teams of Christian people, pastors, evangelists, and lay people who wanted to win people to Christ. And he started putting teams together for all the Olympics that took place ever since 1988, summer and winter games. And so every Olympic games, he brings a team of about 20, 25, 30 Christian evangelists, soul winners, and we come, and basically all we do about 10 to 12 hours a day from the time we get up till we go to sleep is we go out into the Olympic venues, we go out into the city, wherever we can, and we present the gospel of Jesus Christ to people and have an opportunity to tell people about Jesus. It's just a wonderful soul-winning experience.
You are staying in the Copacabana area, which is close to the Atlantic Ocean. Currently, you're in the Olympic Park area. So when you talk to these people, of course, from all over the world, coming in, attending the Olympic Games and watching these various competitions, what is your approach to people as you meet them in the streets and the boardwalk and in parks and such?
That's a good question, Bob. I'm glad you asked it. We have kind of a unique approach as the International Sports Chaplains in the way that we go about introducing the gospel to people. There's an age-old tradition at the Olympics where people trade pins. Every nation has their own specially, uniquely designed, customized pin or badge that you can wear on your shirt. And one of the customs of the Olympics is people like spectators and athletes like to trade pins with people from other countries and see how many pins they can collect. Well, the International Sports Chaplains have developed our own pin, and we call it the Jesus pin because it has the name Jesus on it and has a torch like the Olympic torch, and it has colors. The flags of the world on the outer edge, it's a round pin, and we talk about how God loves the whole world, and then it has the colors of the gospel, you know, gold for heaven, black for a sinful heart, white for a clean heart, red for the blood of Jesus that washes us clean, green for abundant life in Christ. And so using those colors, we're able to introduce people to the gospel of Christ as we confront people throughout the parks and the different venues where we go to witness. And we call it the best pin at the Olympics. It really is a very good quality pin, and it has a lot of weight to it, and people really like to get this pin. And we don't sell them, we don't trade them, we actually give them away, but a person to get one has to be willing to listen to about a 2 or 3 or 4 minute presentation of the gospel explaining what the pin is. And so that's the approach we take as we walk through the Olympic venues and on the beaches and in the city, wherever we go. We cross paths with people from all over the world and simply try to strike up a conversation with them. Usually, a lot of times they come to us, they see the way we're dressed. We have uniforms, t-shirts and hats and lots of pins stuck all over us. And they usually want to know, who are you guys and what are you doing? And that gives us an open door then to start talking about our pin. And the Lord Jesus is, of course, the reason we're there, and we have the privilege of sharing the gospel with them.
Terry Veazey here on The Intersection. You can learn more about the Olympic Outreach at ischaplains.org. His website is terryveazey, V-E-A-Z-E-Y.org. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast with Carl Gallups, who serves as pastor of Hickory Hammock Baptist Church in Milton, Florida. In a recent conversation, he discussed the recent government letter regarding transgender students and bathroom usage and introduced the notion of a notice of compliance letter, which he has developed, designed to protect students who are not transgender. Here now from that conversation is Carl Gallups.
I made my letter, and it says, it's basically notifying school officials, I'm the parent of so-and-so, my child is a student. My child falls into the category of all students that need to be protected. My child possesses a gender identity as well. We celebrate his or her gender identity. We insist that you protect my child's emotional and physical stability. And considering that the DCL is so loosely formulated that any student at any time without any parental authority can go to any school official and they can have access to bathroom, showers, and lockers of the opposite sex, and you have to provide it. You cannot check, you cannot claim that your school record says no because you're a boy or you're a girl. It says, since it's so loosely constructed, we fear for the safety of our child and their gender identity. Therefore, you must protect my child. And therefore, we are now insisting that you provide my child with the Title IX and DCL accommodations of single-use facilities. From this day forward, my child will always have a private bathroom, a private shower, a private locker room, and private sleeping facilities where needed, as long as they are in your custody and care. And if you don't do this, we will immediately file a Title IX lawsuit. Now, I'm telling you, Bob, I've had lawyers look at this. I've had school superintendents, school board members, school teachers look at it who are familiar with Title IX and the DCL, and they've all said, this is bulletproof. You're using the language that's in the law against them. And so what it has done, it has thrown this whole thing into a tizzy. States are suing the government over this. 20 states now are involved. The same week that my letter came out and was in headline news, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, listen, let's stop this whole thing for a while. We're going to hear this case. Because, Bob, and I'm not saying my letter had anything to do with that. I hope it did, but I'm not making that braggadocious claim. I'm just saying, coincidentally, or maybe providentially, at the same time my letter's coming out, the Supreme Court is stepping in and staying this whole mess. And the reason is because you have in order for them to keep Title IX in the DCL, they also have to break Title IX and the DCL. And so they're in a quandary. Now, let me illustrate to you how criminal this whole thing is, Bob. We do a lot of overnight things with our student ministries. We've got a huge student ministry. They do a lot of mission work. They also have a big back-to-school retreat at the end of the summer. All right? They just got back from this back-to-school retreat. Now, think of this. While this is going on in the public schools and in the national media, what if while my kids were on their back-to-school camp facility, we rent the whole facility, it's just us with all of our leaders, they all have criminal background checks and they're all well-known people, and then we've got all of our kids from 12 years old to 17 years old, girls and boys, and we do this huge, big back-to-school retreat. What if I called them up, Bob, and I called my leaders and I said, you know, kids are getting ready to go back to school. A lot of them going into the public schools. They're under this DCL, Title IX order. It's the politically correct thing now. Here's what I'm saying. Since we're preparing them to go back to school, on this retreat, I don't really care what the parents think, because in school they don't get to really say about it, according to the DCL. I'm issuing the order that if any young man comes to you and says, I feel more like a girl, I want to identify with a girl, you have to allow them to use the showers, stay in the sleeping quarters, use the dressing rooms, and use the bathrooms with them. No questions asked. I'm ordering you to do that. Now, nobody in my church would ever do that, Bob, but let's just pretend like they did. And all of these kids come home, and a 13-year-old little girl goes and tells mom and dad, a 17-year-old boy, a senior, came into the showers, pulled his clothes off in front of us, and started showering with us. Then he came into our dormitory and slept with us. Then he came into our bathrooms and used the restroom with us. Now, Bob, consider yourself. What if your 13-year-old girl came home and told you that Pastor Carl did that? And then they ask, well, how did that happen? Pastor Carl called and said that that's how it was going to be. What I'm asking people to consider is, why do the children in my church, why are they protected by civil and criminal law? But my same children in my same community, in my same county, in a few days will step into a public school and they're not protected. You see how criminal this is, Bob, and why my compliance letter is so important for parents to use?
Carl Gallup's here on The Intersection. You can find out more by going to his website, Carl Gallup's, GALLUPS.com. Well, this is the Intersection Podcast. It's a weekly production of The Meeting House. Learn more through the website at meetinghouseonline.info. There you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests on the Intersection Podcast. Also, through that website, you can subscribe to the podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible also. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. Video content is also available through that website. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Well, Stuart Shepherd serves as executive producer of Creative Communications for Family Policy Alliance, a public policy partner of Focus on the Family. He and I had a discussion recently about a U.S. Supreme Court action placing an appeals court ruling on transgender bathroom usage on hold. He also introduced an initiative featuring stories related to the transgender bathroom issue. Here now from that conversation is Stuart Shepherd.
It just keeps the status quo until the Supreme Court can pick this up, likely next year, which of course once again points to the importance of this year's presidential race and what's going to be the future makeup of the Supreme Court. We lost Justice Antonin Scalia this year, and that means that the usually 5-4 divided court, with Anthony Kennedy being the deciding factor on so many social issues cases, it's now 4-4. And not in a good way. I mean, it's probably 5-3, really, not 4-4, but 5-3 on many of these cases, unless even if Kennedy comes across to the conservative side, that's the 4-4. And then it's as if the decision never happened. This decision out of the Fourth Circuit, I mean, in Fourth Circuit, we're talking about Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, Delaware. I'm Maryland, not Delaware. Delaware's in the third. But those states are the ones that are impacted immediately by this decision if it had been allowed to maintain, I won't say stand, because the Supreme Court, it appears, is going to take it up. The three conservatives on the Supreme Court wanted to take this case. The liberals on the court, including the two Obama appointees, said, now we're good with boys going into or girls going into boys' restrooms in Virginia and vice versa. We're fine with that. In fact, we want that. Well, in this case, it was Stephen Breyer, who's on the liberal wing of the court, who actually came across and sided with the conservatives, but he said, and literally said, this is a quote, I vote to grant the application as a courtesy, quote unquote, meaning that this is not indicating that he disagrees with what's going on in Virginia. He just wanted this to come up to the Supreme Court, and the only way to bring it on up then would be if he sided with the four conservatives. It takes four votes for them to hear a case. So that's how this happened. So don't put too much into Breyer coming across with the conservatives, especially since he very specifically spelled out it's a courtesy. Now, this has to do with, and it's so important to get to the definitions here. When we talk about this whole idea of transgenderism, which is it's better for us to say that it's people who are confused about their gender identity. I mean, that's what it comes down to. There's a confusion about it. The only thing that the other side wants in order to qualify under the things that they're proposing as far as regulations and rules, President Obama, of course, put out the directive concerning public schools that we should throw open the locker rooms, restrooms, hotel rooms on school trips for boys and girls to, you know, be in the same room if, and this is the qualification I was working toward, if you say that you're identifying as the other gender. Now, it's critical to understand that. You don't have to feel it necessarily. You don't have to prove it. You don't have to demonstrate it. You just have to be willing to say that you identify as the other gender, because the whole argument from the other side is anything more than that is too much. That merely making the assertion is all that it takes. Once you say that, then you come under all this. One of my colleagues, Autumn Leva, has started a campaign that we're calling Ask Me First. If you go to askmefirstplease.com, askmefirstplease.com, we're going to start collecting stories from a particular group of people who are not being considered in this, whose opinions are not regularly being heard in the mainstream media. When you read stories about this, they always go to the person who is asserting that they're of the other gender. But you know who you're not hearing from, Bob? You know who you're not hearing quoted regularly in the media the way that we should? Moms, daughters. We're not hearing from them. And so what Autumn said is, that's the whole idea of ask me first. You know, I'm a mom. I'm a daughter who's concerned about this. Would someone please ask me? Nobody asked me about this, whether I think this is okay for me to be put in this position, for my daughter to be put in this position, for me as a teenage girl to be put in this position. That's the group that's being left out of this whole conversation. So that's what it's about.
Stuart Shepherd of Family Policy Alliance here on The Intersection. Learn more at familypolicyalliance.com. That site featuring stories related to the transgender bathroom issue can be found at askusplease.com. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast with conversation material from the International Christian Retail Show in Cincinnati. Michelle Perimsky, founder of Team Lady 180 and author of the book 180 Your Life From Tragedy to Triumph, A Woman's Grief Guide, visited the Faith Radio Meeting House Broadcast Center and discussed her journey of grief and some of the steps she took, including health, exercise, and community. From that ICRS conversation, this is Michelle Perimsky.
In 2007, I was married to my best friend. His name is Jason. And I took my daughter. I was pregnant with my second daughter, and I took my oldest, who was 2 and 10 months old at the time, to the aquarium. And when I came home, he had left. And I didn't know where he was for 5 days. And then I got a call from the sheriff's office in North Georgia that he had taken his life. And in that moment, my world just came crashing down. And I was hurled into what I felt like was just chaos, depression, anger. I didn't understand why God would let me be in this situation if I was a devoted wife. And then I gave birth 2 months later, and then 3 months after that, my mom lost her battle with breast cancer. And I just, it was this 5-month period in 2007 that was just so intense. And I was so thankful for the birth of my daughter, Sophia, who just turned 9 this month. But I was also reeling, wondering how I could survive and lead my little family with my 2 daughters in a way that was healthy and empowered and strong. And so over time, I kind of, it's been a 9-year journey for me, and I found things that worked. And I went to a number of grief groups, and I found that, especially in what I saw in church environments, it's really important to talk about processing your loss. And we do that, unfortunately, sometimes around comfort foods or sugar-laden foods, which actually help set your body up for depression, because the grief depletes your body of vital nutrients, and then overly processed foods and sugars also deplete your body. So now you've double depleted your body, and in this verge of depressed state, you're asking God to lift the depression when in fact you're chemically setting yourself up for failure. So what I did was incorporate healthy eating, exercise. I started training for triathlons, and it so revolutionized my family. And I'm not saying that everybody has to train for a triathlon, even if it's a sprint one, which isn't that bad, but train for a 5K together. You know, have a goal in the future that gets you moving, gets you outside, gets you in the sunshine, gets you in community. I call it team, train, triumph now, that you operate as a team, not just a grief group, with a common goal, which is initially a 5K, that you train body, mind, and spirit in healthy and wise choices that are biblically based, and that you triumph by attaining your goal, crossing your finish line, and then helping others on your same path. And I actually started a nonprofit for widows called Team Lady 180. You can find us at teamlady180.com. That's teamlady180.com. And I saw women's lives, grieving moms who were widows, change in just 4.5 months. They went from various degrees of sadness and struggle with being widows and being tired. I understand being really tired as a widowed mom, even a single mom or just as a mom. And they went to feeling empowered, strengthened. They crossed finish lines and said, if I can do this, I can do anything. And that's what I'm really all about, is I want women who are going through trauma, whether it's the loss of a marriage, the loss of a loved one, the loss of a spouse, or a major life change, that they have a pattern that they can follow that creates a foundation of peace and health and wellness in their lives. And so I created, with area experts, I used my journalism expertise and researched it and interviewed different experts and created 180 Your Life, From Tragedy to Triumph, a Woman's Grief Guide, which is a practical roadmap that gives you step-by-step tasks and concepts for a year, so that you can work with your family members, with your loved ones, with your friends, with your small group, to create a foundation of peace, simplifying your home, simplifying your life, simplifying your processes, strengthening your body, attaining your goals, learning to help others. And when I did this, I found this tremendous transformation in my life, this wellspring of joy. And I thought, well, let me write it down. Let me create this program.
Michelle Peremski here on The Intersection. You can find out more by going to the website 180 Your Life. That's 180yourlife.com. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast with Matt Staver, founder and chairman of Liberty Counsel. In a phone conversation, he gave an update on the case involving Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, who at the time of the conversation was facing a complaint about an order he had written following the U.S. Supreme Court's Obergefell decision. There was a hearing before the Alabama Court of the Judiciary on August the 8th. At that hearing, it was decided that the Chief Justice would face trial on September the 28th. Here now from that conversation with some analysis is Matt Staver.
They allege that he was in violation by virtue of a January 2016 administrative order that he issued. The JIC then filed a charge against the Chief Justice, And that automatically removes a judge from the bench. Whenever you get a charge from the JIC, it's very unusual. Alabama is the only state in the country that has such a provision, that when a judge is charged for anything, they are automatically removed from the bench. So he automatically got removed from the bench. And then the JIC went out and hired a former legal director from the Southern Poverty Law Center, the very group that filed the complaint, to prosecute the case against the Chief Justice. So that's how we're here. Now, they filed a complaint and focuses on this January 2016 administrative order. It's a four-page order. Anyone can read it. And when you read it, you're scratching your head at the end. What did he do wrong? Obviously, nothing. He, in fact, said he was not at liberty to give advice to the probate judges regarding what they should do, because that matter was presently under consideration by the Alabama Supreme Court, and a ruling would be coming forth in the future. It was essentially a status decision, letting the probate judges know what the status of the pending case before the Alabama Supreme Court was, because back in June of 2015, they had asked the parties to brief the case following the Supreme Court's opinion on marriage, and 6 months went by and no ruling came out. On the very day of the sixth month, that's when the Chief Justice issued this administrative ruling. It's only four pages, very easy to read. And it just simply says that he's not at liberty to give direction or advice. The matter is under consideration by the Alabama Supreme Court, and a ruling will be coming shortly. He didn't say when. He didn't say what the ruling would be. And 2 months later, the Supreme Court of Alabama did issue the ruling. And that's unbelievably the focus of this charge by the JIC.
So does it strictly deal with this particular order, or are there some other factors that are part of these charges?
It strictly deals with this order. It's unbelievable. It strictly deals with this order. When you're thinking of ethical charges, the JIC is made up of both judges, lawyers, and non-lawyers. So that ought to ring a bell. Why would non-lawyers be on a bench like that? Well, it's because it's not a legal determination group. They don't make decisions on the law. They don't resolve legal opinions. And in fact, the Alabama Supreme Court is much higher than them in terms of that's their ultimate job. That's how they're set up in the state constitution, is to resolve legal issues, not the JIC. The JIC looks at facts. And for example, in most cases, you might have, say, a judge that is presiding over a case in which that judge has a financial interest in the outcome of the case. So when the judge rules in favor of a party, he also or she also is benefited because they're financially invested in the outcome of that case. Well, that's facts, and you would look at, did the judge rule on this? Did he know what the parties represented? And what evidence was there? Did he own stock? Was he on the board of directors? What evidence was it that he was going to financially benefit? That would be clearly a factual issue. That would be clearly a matter if the judge stayed on a case, issued a ruling, and benefited from the outcome of directly by the people that were in front of him or her, then that's a problem. That's an ethical charge. Or it might be that a judge or an attorney, for example, gets a settlement and they have money in their trust account and they go out and use that money for a personal benefit rather than holding it for the client. Well, you look at the facts of that. You look at the bank records and the accounting and you determine, did that judge or that lawyer violate an ethical obligation? Here, what you have is a four-page order. It's no facts. It's just the order. It's nothing that he did. It's just the order itself. And so that ought to make you wonder, when they're looking at an order, that's a legal issue. And when the order doesn't direct judges to do one thing or another, and when it doesn't agree or disagree with or take any position regarding the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage opinion, then how can they charge him? This case, from the very beginning, has been politically motivated. Started by the SPLC, they hired a former SPLC legal director, and they charged him on something that they have no business charging him, which in no way is a violation of the ethical rules.
Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel here on The Intersection. The Liberty Counsel website is lc.org. Well, we are nearing the end of this edition of The Intersection podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Through that site, you'll find a link to the Download Center. You can also subscribe to the podcast through that website. Also, there are two blogs accessible. One is The Three, with three stories of relevance to the Christian community. The other is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House program. Also, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. Video content is accessible also, including content from the International Christian Retail Show in Cincinnati. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Intersection Podcast. I'm Bob Crittenden.